at first not understanding. Then his eyebrow went up. For the first time he seemed to consider Roland and the others not as living symbols of the affiliation and the inner baronies, but as actual human beings. Young ones, only boys when you got right down to it.
I?
Draw ours from that, if you'd be so kind. He felt all eyes upon them now, her eyes particularly. He kept his own firmly fixed on the rancher. But his peripheral vision was good, and he was very aware that Jonas's thin smile had resurfaced. Jonas knew what this was about already. Roland supposed Thorin and Reimer did as well. These country mice knew a lot, more than they should, and he would need to think about that carefully later. It was the least of his concerns at the current moment, however. "We have forgotten the faces of our fathers, in a matter that has some bearing on our posting to Hambry." Roland was uncomfortably aware that he was now making a speech, like it or not. It wasn't the whole room he was addressing, thank the gods for little blessings, but the circle of listeners had grown well beyond the original group. Yet there was nothing for it but to finish. The boat was launched. "I needn't go into details, nor would you expect them, I know. But I should say that we promised not to indulge in spirits during our time here, as penance, you see." Her gaze. He could still feel it on his skin, it seemed. For a moment there was complete quiet in the little group around the punch bowls, and then Lengil said, "Your father would be proud to hear you speak so frank, Will Dearborn. Aye, so he would. And what boy worth his salt didn't get up to a little noise and wind from time to time?" He clapped Roland on the shoulder, and although the grip of his hand was firm and his smile looked genuine, his eyes were hard to read, only gleams of speculation deep in those beds of wrinkles. "In his place, may I be proud for him?" "Yes," Roland said, smiling in return, "and with my thanks."
"And mine," Cuthbert said.
"Mine as well,"
Alan said quietly, taking the offered cup of soft punch and bowing to Lengil. Lengil filled more cups and handed them rapidly around. Those already holding cups found them plucked away and replaced with fresh cups of the soft punch. When each of the immediate group had one, Lengil turned, apparently intending to offer the toast himself. Reimer tapped him on the shoulder, shook his head slightly, and cut his eyes toward the mayor. That worthy was looking at them with his eyes rather popped and his jaw slightly dropped. To Roland he looked like an enthralled playgoer in a penny seat. All he needed was a lapful of orange peel. Lengil followed the Chancellor's glance, and then nodded. Reimer next caught the eye of the guitar player standing at the center of the musicians. He stopped playing, so did the others. The guests looked that way, then back to the center of the room when Thorin began speaking. There was nothing ridiculous about his voice when he put it to use as he now did. It was carrying and pleasant.
"Ladies and gentlemen, my friends," he said, "I would ask you to help me in welcoming three new friends, young men from the inner baronies, fine young men who have dared great distances and many perils on behalf of the affiliation and in the service of order and peace."
Susan Delgado set her punch cup aside, retrieved her hand with some difficulty from her uncle's grip, and began to clap. Others joined in. The applause which swept the room was brief but warm. Eldred Jonas did not, Roland noticed, put his cup aside to join in. Thorin turned to Roland, smiling. He raised his cup.
"May I set you on with a word, Will Dearborn?"
"Aye, so you may, and with thanks," Roland said. There was laughter and fresh applause at his usage. Thorin raised his cup even higher. Everyone else in the room followed suit. Crystal gleamed like star points in the light of the chandelier.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I give you William Dearborn of Hemp Hill, Richard Stockworth of Pendleton, and Arthur Heath of Gilead."
Gasps and murmurs at that last, as if their mayor had announced Arthur Heath of Heaven.
"Take of them well, give to them well, make their days and mages sweet, and their memories sweeter. help them in their work, and to advance the causes which are so dear to all of us. May their days be long upon the earth, so says your mayor.
So say we all, they thundered back. Thorin drank. The rest followed his example. There was fresh applause. Roland turned, helpless to stop himself, and found Susan's eyes again at once. For a moment she looked at him fully, and in her frank gaze he saw that she was nearly as shaken by his presence as he was by hers. Then the older woman, who looked like her, bent and murmured something into her ear. Susan turned away, her face a composed mask. But he had seen her regard in her eyes, and thought again that what was done might be undone, and what was spoken might be unspoken. 8. As they passed into the dining hall, which had tonight been set with 4 long trestle tables, so close there was barely room to move between them, Cordelia tugged her niece's hand, pulling her back from the mayor and Jonas, who had fallen into conversation with Fran Lengill.
"Why looked you at him so, miss?" Cordelia whispered furiously.
The vertical line had appeared on her forehead. Tonight it looked as deep as a trench.
"What ails thy pretty, stupid head?"
"Thy." Just that was enough to tell Susan that her aunt was in a fine rage.
"Looked at who and how?"
Her tone sounded right, she thought, but oh, her heart. The hand over hers clamped down, hurting.
"Play no fiddle with me, Miss Oh So Young and Pretty. Have ye ever seen that fine turn row of pins before? Tell me the truth."
"No, how could I? Aunt, you're hurting me."
Aunt Cord smiled balefully and clamped down harder.
"Better a small hurt now than a large one later. Curb your impudence and curb your flirtatious eyes."
"Aunt, I don't know what you—"
"I think you do,"
Cordelia said grimly, pressing her niece close to the wood paneling to allow the guests to stream past them. When the rancher who owned the boathouse next to theirs said hello, Aunt Cord smiled pleasantly at him and wished him good even before turning back to Susan.
"Mind me, miss. Mind me well. If I saw your cow's eyes, ye may be sure that half the company saw. Well, what's done is done, but it stops now. Your time for such child-made games is over, do you understand?"
Susan was silent, her face setting in those stubborn lines Cordelia hated most of all. It was an expression that always made her feel like slapping her headstrong niece until her nose bled and her great gray doe's eyes gushed tears.
"Ye've made a vow and a contract. Papers have been passed, the weird woman has been consulted, money has changed hands, and ye have given your promise. If that means nothing to such as yourself, girl, remember what it did mean to your father."
Tears rose in Susan's eyes again, and Cordelia was glad to see them. Her brother had been an improvident irritation, capable of producing only this far too pretty woman-child. But he had his uses, even dead.
"Now promise ye'll keep your eyes to yourself, and that if ye see that boy coming, ye'll swing wide, aye, wide's you can, to stay out of his way."
"I promise, Aunt," Susan whispered, "I do."
Cordelia smiled. She was really quite pretty when she smiled.
"It's well, then. Let's go in. We're being looked at. Hold my arm, child."
Susan clasped her aunt's powdered arm. They entered the room side by side, their dresses rustling, the sapphire pendant on the swell of Susan's breast flashing. And many there were who remarked upon how alike they looked, and how well pleased poor old Pat Delgado would have been with them. 9. Roland was seated near the head of the center table, between Hash Renfrew, a rancher even bigger and blockier than Lengill, and Thorin's rather morose sister, Coral. Renfrew had been handy with the punch. Now, as the soup was brought to table, he set about proving himself equally adept with the ale. He talked about the fishing trade.
"Not what it used to be, boy, although it's less muties they pull up in their nets these days, and that's a blessin'.
The farming trade.
Folks around here can grow most anything, long as it's corn or beans."
And finally about those things clearly closest to his heart, horsin', coursin', and ranchin'. Those businesses went on as always, aye, so they did, although times had been hard in the grass and seacoast baronies for 40 year or more. Weren't the bloodlines clarifying, Roland asked, for they had begun to do so where he came from. Aye, Renfrew agreed, ignoring his potato soup and gobbling barbecued beef strips instead. These he scooped up with a bare hand and washed down with more ale. Aye, young master, bloodlines was clarifying wonderful well. Indeed they were. 3 colts out of every 5 were threaded stock, in thoroughbred as well as common lines, can it? And the 4th could be kept and worked, if not bred. Only 1 in 5 these days born with extra legs or extra eyes or its guts on the outside, and that was good. But the birth rates were way down, so they were. The stallions had as much ram as ever in their ramrods, it seemed, but not as much powder and ball. "Begging your pardon, ma'am," Renfrew said, leaning briefly across Roland to Coral Thorin. She smiled her thin smile. It reminded Roland of Jonas's, trudged her spoon through her soup, and said nothing. Renfrew emptied his ale cup, smacked his lips heartily, and held the cup out again. As it was recharged, he turned back to Roland. Things weren't good, not as they once had been, but they could be worse. Would be worse if that bugger Farson had his way. This time he didn't bother excusing himself to Cy Thorin. They all had to pull together. That was the ticket, rich and poor, great and small, while pulling could still do some good. And then he seconded Lengil, telling Roland that whatever he and his friends wanted, whatever they needed, they had only to name it. "Information should be enough," Roland said. "Numbers of things."
"I can't be a counter without numbers," Renfrew agreed and sprayed beery laughter.
On Roland's left hand, Coral Thorin nibbled a bit of green, the beef strip she had not so much as touched, smiled her narrow smile, and went on boating with her spoon. Roland guessed there was nothing wrong with her ears, though, and that her brother might get a complete report of their conversation. Or possibly it would be Reimer to get the report. For while it was too early to say for sure, Roland had an idea that Reimer might be the real force here, along perhaps with Cy Jonas. "For instance," Roland said, "how many riding horses do you think we may be able to report back to the affiliation?"
"Tithe or total?"
"Total." Renfrew put his cup down and appeared to calculate. As he did, Roland looked across the table and saw Lengel and Henry Wertner, the barony's stockliner, exchange a quick glance. They had heard. And he saw something else as well when he returned his attention to his seatmate. Hash Renfrew was drunk, but likely not as drunk as he wanted young Will Dearborn to believe.
"Total, you say? Not just what we owe the affiliation or might be able to send along in a pinch."
"Yes."
"Well, let's see, young Cy. Fran must run 140 head. John Croydon's got near 100. Hank Wertner's got 40 on his own hook and must run 60 more out along the drop for the barony. Government all slash, Mr. Dearborn."
Roland smiled. "I know it well. Split hoofs, low necks, no speed, bottomless bellies." Renfrew laughed hard at that, nodding. But Roland found himself wondering if the man was really amused. In Hambry, the waters on top and the waters down below seemed to run in different directions.
"As for myself, I've had a bad 10 or 12 year, sand eye, brain fever, cabards. At one time there was 200 head of running horses out there on the drop with a Lazy Susan brand on them. Now there can't be more than 80.
Roland nodded. "So we're speaking of 420 head.
"Oh, more than that," Renfrew said with a laugh.
He went to pick up his ale cup, struck it with the side of one work and weather-reddened hand, knocked it over, cursed, picked it up, then cursed the ale boy who came slow to refill it. "More than that?" Roland prompted, when Renfrew was finally cocked and locked and ready to resume action.
"You have to remember, Mr. Dearborn, that this is hoss country more'n it's fisher country. We josh each other, we and the fishers, but there's many a scale scraper got a nag put away behind his house, or in the barony stables if they have no roof of their own to keep the rain off a hoss's head. 'Twas her poor dad used to keep the barony stables."
Renfrew nodded toward Susan, who was seated across and 3 seats up from Roland himself, just a table's turn from the mayor, who was, of course, seated at the head. Roland found her placement there passing peculiar, especially given the fact that the mayor's missus had been seated almost all the way at the far end of the table, with Cuthbert on one side of her and some rancher to whom they had not yet been introduced on her other. Roland supposed an old fellow like Thorin might like to have a pretty young relation near at hand to help draw attention to him or to cheer up his own eye. But it still seemed odd. Almost an insult to one's wife. If he was tired of her conversation, why not put her at the head of another table? They have their own customs, that's all. And the customs of the country aren't your concern. This man's crazy horse count is your concern. How many other running horses, would you say? He asked Renfrew. In all. Renfrew gazed at him shrewdly. An honest answer will not come back to haunt me, will it, sonny? I'm an affiliation man, so I am affiliation to the Corps. I'll carve Excalibur on my grave head like as not. But I'd not see Hambry and Magus stripped of all its treasure. That won't happen, Si. How could we force you to give up what you don't want to in any case? Such forces as we have are all committed in the north and west against the good man. Renfrew considered this, then nodded. And may I not be will to you? Renfrew brightened, nodded, and offered his hand a second time. He grinned broadly when Roland this time shook it in both of his, the over-and-under grip preferred by drovers and cowboys. "These are bad times we live in, Will, and they've bred bad manners. I'd guess there's probably another 150 head of horse in and about Magus. Good ones is what I mean." "Big hat stock." Renfrew nodded, clapped Roland on the back, ingested a goodly quaff of ale. "Big hats, aye." From the top of their table there came a burst of laughter. Jonas had apparently said something funny. Susan laughed without reservation, her head tilted back and her hands clasped before the sapphire pendant. Cordelia, who sat with the girl on her left and Jonas on her right, was also laughing. Thorin was absolutely convulsed, rocking back and forth in his chair, wiping his eyes with a napkin. "Yon's a lovely girl," Renfrew said. He spoke almost reverently. Roland could not quite swear that a small sound, a womanly hum, perhaps, had come from his other side. He glanced in that direction and saw Si Thorin still sporting with her soup. He looked back toward the head of the table. "Is the mayor her uncle, or perhaps her cousin?" Roland asked. What happened next had a heightened clarity in his memory, as if someone had turned up all the colors and sounds of the world. The velvet swags behind Susan suddenly seemed a brighter red. The caw of laughter, which came from Coral Thorin, was the sound of a breaking branch. It was surely loud enough to make everyone in the vicinity stop their conversations and look at her, Roland thought. Except only Renfrew and the two ranchers across the table did. "Her uncle!" It was her first conversation of the evening. "Her uncle! That's good, eh, Rennie?" Renfrew said nothing, only pushed his ale cup away and finally began to eat his soup. "I'm surprised at you, young man. So I am. You may be from the in-world. But, oh, goodness, whoever tended to your education of the real world, and one outside of books and maps, stopped a mite short, I'd say. She's his..." And then a word so thick with dialect that Roland had no idea what it was. "Seafin," it sounded, or perhaps "Sheevin." "I beg pardon?" He was smiling, but the smile felt cold and false on his mouth. There was a heaviness in his belly, as if the punch and the soup and the single beef strip he had eaten for politeness' sake had all lumped together in his stomach. "Do you serve?" he'd asked her, meaning did she serve at table. Mayhap she did serve, but likely she did it in a room rather more private than this. Suddenly he wanted to hear no more, had not the slightest interest in the meaning of the word the mayor's sister had used. Another burst of laughter rocked the top of the table. Susan laughed with her head back, her cheeks glowing, her eyes sparkling. One strap of her dress had slipped down her arm, disclosing the tender hollow of her shoulder. As he watched, his heart full of fear and longing, She brushed it absently back into place with the palm of her hand.
"It means quiet, little woman," Renfrew said, clearly uncomfortable. "It's an old term, not used much these days."
"Stop it, Rennie," said Carl Thorin. Then, to Roland, "He's just an old cowboy and can't quit shoveling horse shit even when he's away from his beloved nags. Sheevin means sidewife. In the time of my great-grandmother, it meant whore, but one of a certain kind."
She looked with a pale eye at Susan, who was now sipping ale, then turned back to Roland. There was a species of baleful amusement in her gaze, an expression that Roland liked little.
"The kind of whore you had to pay for in coin. The kind too fine for the trade of simple folk."
"She's as jilly?" Roland asked, through lips which felt as if they had been iced.
"Aye," Coral said. "Not consummated, not until the reap, and none too happy about that is my brother, I'll warrant. But bought and paid for, just as in the old days, so she is."
Coral paused, then said,
"Her father would die of shame if he could see her."
She spoke with a kind of melancholy satisfaction.
"I hardly think we should judge the mayor too harshly," Renfrew said in an embarrassed, pontificating voice.
Coral ignored him. She studied the line of Susan's jaw, the soft swell of her bosom above the silken edge of her bodice, the fall of her hair. The thin humor was gone from Coral Thorin's face. In it now was a somehow chilling species of contempt. In spite of himself, Roland found himself imagining the mayor's knuckle-bunchy hands pushing down the straps of Susan's dress, crawling over her naked shoulders, plunging like gray crabs into the cave beneath her hair. He looked away toward the table's lower end, and what he saw there was no better. It was Olive Thorin that his eye found. Olive, who had been relegated to the foot of the table. Olive looking up at the laughing folk who sat at its head. Looking up at her husband, who had replaced her with a beautiful young girl and gifted that girl with a pendant which made her own fire-dim earrings look dowdy by comparison. There was none of Coral's hatred and angry contempt on her face. Looking at her might have been easier if that were so. She only gazed at her husband with eyes that were humble, hopeful, and unhappy. Now Roland understood why he had thought her sad. She had every reason to be sad. More laughter from the mayor's party. Reimer had leaned over from the next table where he was presiding to contribute some witticism. It must have been a good one. This time even Jonas was laughing. Susan put a hand to her bosom, then took her napkin and raised it to wipe a tear of laughter from the corner of her eye. Thorin covered her other hand. She looked toward Roland and met his eyes, still laughing. He thought of Olive Thorin sitting down there at the foot of the table with the salt and spices, an untouched bowl of soup before her, and that unhappy smile on her face, seated where the girl could see her as well. And he thought that had he been wearing his guns, he might well have drawn one and put a bullet in Susan Delgado's cold and whoring little heart. And thought, who do you hope to fool? Then one of the serving boys was there, putting a plate of fish in front of him. Roland thought he had never felt less like eating in his life. But he would eat, just the same, just as he would turn his mind to the questions raised by his conversation with Hash Renfrew of the Lazy Susan Ranch. He would remember the face of his father. Yes, I'll remember it very well, he thought. If only I could forget the one above yon sapphire. 10. The dinner was interminable, and there was no escape afterward. The table at the center of the reception room had been removed, and when the guests came back that way, like a tide which has surged as high as it can and now ebbs, they formed two adjacent circles at the direction of a sprightly little red-haired man, whom Cuthbert later dubbed Mayor Thorin's Minister of Fun. The boy-girl, boy-girl, boy-girl circling was accomplished with much laughter and some difficulty. Roland guessed that about three-quarters of the guests were now fairly well shottered. And then the guitarist struck up a caissa. This proved to be a simple sort of reel. The circles revolved in opposite directions, all holding hands, until the music stopped for a moment. Then the couple created, at the place where the two circles touched, danced at the center of the female partner's circle, while everyone else clapped and cheered. The lead musician managed this old and clearly well-loved tradition with a keen eye to the ridiculous, stopping his muchachos in order to create the most amusing couples. Tall woman, short man, fat woman, skinny man, old woman, young man. Cuthbert ended up sidekicking with a woman as old as his great-granddam, to the sigh's breathless cackles and the company's general roars of approval. Then, just when Roland was thinking this stupid dance would never end, the music stopped, and he found himself facing Susan Delgado. For a moment he could do nothing but stare at her, feeling that his eyes must burst from their sockets, feeling that he could move neither of his stupid feet. Then she raised her arms, the music began, the circle, this one included Mayor Thorin, and the watchful, narrowly smiling Eldred Jonas applauded, and he led her into the dance. At first, as he spun her through a figure, his feet moved with all their usual grace and precision, numb or not. He felt like a man made of glass. Then he became aware of her body touching his, and the rustle of her dress, and he was all too human again. She moved closer for a moment, and when she spoke, her breath tickled in his ear. He wondered if a woman could drive you mad, literally mad. He wouldn't have believed so before tonight. But tonight everything had changed. "Thank you for your discretion and your propriety," she whispered. He pulled back from her a little, and at the same time twirled her, his hand against the small of her back, palm resting on cool satin, fingers touching warm skin. Her feet followed his with never a pause or stutter. They moved with perfect grace, unafraid of his great and booted clod-stompers, even in their flimsy silk slippers. "I can be discreet, Si," he said. "As for propriety, I'm amazed you even know the word." She looked up into his cold face, her smile fading. He saw anger come in to fill it, but before anger there was hurt, as if he had slapped her. He felt both glad and sorry at the same time. "Why do you speak so?" she whispered. The music stopped before he could answer, although how he might have answered he had no idea. She curtsied and he bowed, while those surrounding them clapped and whistled. They went back to their places, to their separate circles, and the guitars began again. Roland felt his hands grasped on either side and began to turn with the circle once more. Laughing, kicking, clapping on the beat, feeling her somewhere behind him doing the same, wondering if she wanted as badly as he did to be out of here, to be in the dark, to be alone in the dark, where he could put his false face aside before the real one beneath could grow hot enough to set it afire. Chapter 6 Shimi 1 Around 10 of the clock, the trio of young men from the inner baronies made their manners to host and hostess, then slipped off into the fragrant summer night. Cordelia Delgado, who happened to be standing near Henry Wertner, the barony's stockliner, remarked that they must be tired. Wertner laughed at this, and replied in an accent so thick it was almost comic, "Nay, ma'am, boys that age are like rats exploring in woodpile after huck it rains, so they are. It'll be hours yet before the bunks out to barque sees 'em." Olive Thorin left the public room shortly after the boys, pleading a headache. She was pale enough to be almost believable. By 11, the mayor, his chancellor, and the chief of his newly inaugurated security staff were conversing in the mayor's study with the last few late-staying guests, all ranchers, all members of the Horsemen's Association. The talk was brief, but intense. Several of the ranchers present expressed relief that the affiliation's emissaries were so young. Eldred Jonas said nothing to this, only looked down at his pale, long-fingered hands and smiled his narrow smile. By midnight, Susan was at home and undressing for bed. She didn't have the sapphire to worry about, at least. That was a barony jewel and had been tucked back into the strongbox at Mayor's house before she left, despite what Mr. Ain't We Fine Will Dearborn might think about it and her. Mayor Thorin, she couldn't bring herself to call him Hart, although he had asked her to do so, not even to herself could she do it, had taken it back from her himself. In the hallway, just off from the reception room that had been, by the tapestry showing Arthur Eld carrying his sword out of the pyramid in which it had been entombed. And he, Thorin, not the Eld, had taken the opportunity to kiss her mouth and have a quick fumble at her breasts, a part of her that had felt much too naked during that entire interminable evening.
"I burn for reaping,"
he had whispered melodramatically in her ear. His breath had been redolent of brandy.
"Each day of this summer seems an age."
Now, in her room, brushing her hair with harsh, quick strokes and looking out at the waning moon, she thought she had never been so angry in her life as she was at this moment. Angry at Thorin, angry at Aunt Cord, furious with that self-righteous prig of a Will Dearborn. Most of all, however, she was angry at herself. "There's three things you can do in any situation, girl," her father had told her once. "You can decide to do a thing, you can decide not to do a thing, or you can decide not to decide." That last, her dad had never quite come out and said he hadn't needed to, was the choice of weaklings and fools. She had promised herself she would never elect it herself, and yet she had allowed herself to drift into this ugly situation. Now all the choices seemed bad and honorless, all the roads either filled with rocks or hub-deep in mud. In her room at Mayor's house, she had not shared a chamber with Hart for 10 years, or a bed even briefly for 5, Olive sat in a nightdress of undecorated white cotton, also looking out at the waning moon. After closing herself into this safe and private place, she had wept, but not for long. Now she was dry-eyed and felt as hollow as a dead tree. And what was the worst? That Hart didn't understand how humiliated she was, and not just for herself. He was too busy strutting and preening, also too busy trying to look down the front of Cy Delgado's dress at every opportunity, to know that people, his own chancellor among them, were laughing at him behind his back. That might stop when the girl had returned to her aunt's with a big belly, but that wouldn't be for months yet. The witch had seen to that. It would be even longer if the girl kindled slowly. And what was the silliest, most humiliating thing of all? That she, John Haverty's daughter, Olive, still loved her husband. Hart was an overweening, vainglorious, prancing loon of a man, but she still loved him. There was something else, something quite apart from the matter of Hart's turning into Georgia goats in his late middle age. She thought there was an intrigue of some sort going on, something dangerous and quite likely dishonorable. Hart knew a little about it, but she guessed he knew only what Kimba Reimer and that hideous limping man wanted him to know. There was a time, and not so long ago, when Hart wouldn't have allowed himself to be fobbed off in such fashion by the likes of Reimer, a time when he would have taken one look at Eldred Jonas and his friends and sent them west ere they had so much as a single hot dinner in them. But that was before Hart had become besotted with Cy Delgado's gray eyes, high bosom, and flat belly. Olive turned down the lamp, blew out the flame, and crept off to bed, where she would lie wakeful until dawn. By 1 o'clock, no one was left in the public rooms of Mayor's house except for a quartet of cleaning women who performed their chores silently and nervously beneath the eye of Eldred Jonas. When one of them looked up and saw him gone from the window seat where he had been sitting and smoking, she murmured softly to her friends, and they all loosened up a little. But there was no singing, no laughter. Il Spectro, the man with the blue coffin on his hand, might only have stepped back into the shadows. He might still be watching. By 2 o'clock, even the cleaning women were gone. It was an hour at which a party in Gilead would just have been reaching its apogee of glitter and gossip. But Gilead was far away. Not just in another barony, but almost in another world. This was the outer ark, and in the outers even gentry went to bed early. There was no gentry on view at the Traveler's Rest, however, and beneath the all-encompassing gaze of the romp, the night was still fairly young. 2. At one end of the saloon, fishermen, still wearing their rolled-down boots, drank and played watch-me for small stakes. To their right was a poker table. To their left, a knot of yelling, exhorting men, cowpokes mostly, stood along Satan's Alley, watching the dice bounce down the velvet incline. At the room's other end, Sheb McCurdy was pounding out jagged boogie, right hand flying, left hand pumping, the sweat pouring down his neck and pale cheeks. Beside and above him, standing drunk on a stool, Petty the Trotter shook her enormous bottom and bawled out the words to the song at the top of her voice.
Come on over, baby, we got chicken in the barn. What barn? Whose barn? My barn. Come on over, baby, baby got the bull by the horns.
Sheemy stopped beside the piano, the camel bucket in one hand, grinning up at her and attempting to sing along. Petty swatted him on his way, never missing a word, bump, or grind, and Sheemy went, with his peculiar laugh, which was shrill but somehow not unpleasant. A game of darts was in progress. In a booth near the back, a whore who styled herself Countess Jillian of Upper Killian, exiled royalty from distant Garland, my dears, oh, how special we are, was managing to give two hand jobs at the same time while smoking a pipe. And at the bar, a whole line of assorted toughs, drifters, cowpunchers, drovers, drivers, carters, wheelwrights, stagies, carpenters, conmen, stockmen, boatmen, and gunmen, drank beneath the romp's double head. The only real gunmen in the place were at the end of the bar, a pair drinking by themselves. No one attempted to join them, and not just because they wore shooting irons in holsters that were slung low and tied down gunslinger fashion. Guns were uncommon but not unknown in Magus at that time and not necessarily feared. But these two had the sullen look of men who have spent a long day doing work they didn't want to do. The look of men who would pick a fight on no account at all and be glad to end their day by sending some new widow's husband home in a hurry-up wagon. Stanley the bartender served them whiskey after whiskey with no attempt to make conversation. Not so much as a hot day, gents, wasn't it? They reeked of sweat, and their hands were pitchy with pine gum. Not enough to keep Stanley from being able to see the blue coffin shapes tattooed on them, though. Their friend, the old limping buzzard with the girl's hair and the gimp leg, wasn't here, at least. In Stanley's view, Jonas was easily the worst of the big coffin hunters, but these two were bad enough, and he had no intention of getting a slant of them if he could help it. With luck, no one would. They looked tired enough to call it a night early. Reynolds and DePape were tired, all right. They had spent the day out at Citgo, camouflaging a line of empty steel tankers with nonsense words, Texaco, Citgo, Sunoco, Exxon, printed on their sides. A billion pine boughs they'd hauled and stacked, it seemed. But they had no consequent plans to finish their drinking early. DePape might have done so if her nibs had been available, but that young beauty, actual name Gert Moggins, had a ranch job and wouldn't be back until two nights hence.
"And it'll be a week if there's hard cash on offer,"
DePape said morosely. He pushed his spectacles up on his nose.
"Fuck her," Reynolds said. "That's just what I'd do if I could, but I can't."
"I'm gonna get me a plate of that free lunch," Reynolds said, pointing down to the other end of the bar, where a tin bucket of steamed clams had just come out of the kitchen.
"You want some?
Them look like hocks of snot and go down the same way. Bring me a strip of beef jerky."
"All right, partner."
Reynolds went off down the bar. People gave him wide passage, gave even his silk-lined cloak wide passage. DePape, more morose than ever now that he had thought of her nibs gobbling cowboy spare ribs out there at the piano ranch, downed his drink, winced at the stench of pine gum on his hand, then held his glass out in Stanley Ruiz's direction.
"Fill this up, you dog!" he shouted.
A cowhand, leaning with his back, butt, and elbows against the bar, jerked forward at the sound of DePape's bellow, and that was all it took to start trouble. Sheemy was bustling through the pass-through from which the steamers had just appeared, now holding the camel bucket out before him in both hands. Later, when the travelers began to empty out, his job would be to clean up. For now, however, it was simply to circulate with the camel bucket, dumping in every unfinished drink he found. This combined elixir ended up in a jug behind the bar. The jug was labeled, fairly enough, camel piss, and a double shot could be obtained for 3 pennies. It was a drink only for the reckless or the impecunious, but a fair number of both passed beneath the stern gaze of the romp each night. Stanley rarely had a problem emptying the jug. And if it wasn't empty at the end of the night, why, there was always a fresh night coming along, not to mention a fresh supply of thirsty fools. But on this occasion, Sheeny never made it to the camel piss jug behind the end of the bar. He tripped over the boot of the cowboy who had jerked forward and went to his knees with a grunt of surprise. The contents of the bucket sloshed out ahead of him, and following Satan's first law of malignity, to wit, if the worst can happen, it usually will, they drenched Roy DePape from the knees down in an eye-watering mixture of beer, graff, and white lightning. Conversation at the bar stopped. And that stopped the talk of the men gathered around the dice chute. Sheb turned, saw Sheeny kneeling before one of Jonas's men, and stopped playing. Petty, her eyes squeezed shut as she poured her entire soul into her singing, continued on a cappella for 3 or 4 bars before registering the silence, which was spreading out like a ripple. She stopped singing and opened her eyes. That sort of silence usually meant that someone was going to be killed. If so, she didn't intend to miss it. DePape stood perfectly still, inhaling the raw stench of alcohol as it rose. He didn't mind the smell. On the whole, it had the stink of pine gum beat 6 ways to the peddler. He didn't mind the way his pants were sticking to his knees, either. It might have been a bit of an irritation if some of that joy juice had gotten down inside his boots, but none had. His hand fell to the butt of his gun. Here, by God and by Goddess, was something to take his mind off his sticky hands and absent whore. And good entertainment was ever worth a little wedding. Silence blanketed the place now. Stanley stood as stiff as a soldier behind the bar, nervously plucking at one of his arm garters. At the bar's other end, Reynolds looked back toward his partner with bright interest. He took a clam from the steaming bucket and cracked it on the edge of the bar like a boiled egg. At DePape's feet, Sheeny looked up, his eyes big and fearful beneath the wild snarl of his black hair. He was trying his best to smile.
"Well now, boy," DePape said, "you have wet me considerable."
"Sorry, big fella, I go trippy trip."
Sheeny jerked a hand back over his shoulder. A little spray of camel piss flew from the tips of his fingers. Somewhere someone cleared his throat nervously. The room was full of eyes, and quiet enough so that they could all hear both the wind in the eaves and the waves breaking on the rocks of Hambury Point, 2 miles away.
"Well, hell, you did,"
said the cowpoke who had jerked. He was about 20 and suddenly afraid he might never see his mother again.
"Don't you go trying to put your trouble off on me, you damn feeb."
"I don't care how it happened," DePape said.
He was aware he was playing for an audience, and knew what an audience mostly wants is to be entertained. Cy R.B. DePape, always a trooper, intended to oblige. He pinched the corduroy of his pants above the knees and pulled the legs up, revealing the toes of his boots. They were shiny and wet.
"See there! Look what you got on my boots!"
Sheeny looked up at him, grinning and terrified. Stanley Ruiz decided he couldn't let this happen without at least trying to stop it. He had known Dolores Schemer, the boy's mother. There was even a possibility that he himself was the boy's father. In any case, he liked Sheeny. The boy was foolish, but his heart was good. He never took a drink, and he always did his work. Also, he could find a smile for you, even on the coldest, foggiest winter's day. That was a talent many people of normal intelligence did not have. "Cy DePape," he said, taking a step forward and speaking in a low, respectful tone. "I'm very sorry about that. I'll be happy to buy your drinks for the rest of the evening, if we can just forget this regrettable DePape's movement was a blur almost too fast to see." But that wasn't what amazed the people who were in the rest that night. They would have expected a man running with Jonas to be fast. What amazed them was the fact that he never looked around to set his target. He located Stanley by his voice alone. DePape drew his gun and swept it to the right in a rising arc. It struck Stanley Ruiz dead in the mouth, mashing his lips and shattering three of his teeth. Blood splashed the back bar mirror. Several high-flying drops decorated the tip of the romp's left-hand nose. Stanley screamed, clapped his hands to his face, and staggered back against the shelf behind him. In the silence, the chattery clink of the bottles was very loud. Down the bar, Reynolds cracked another clam and watched, fascinated. Good as a play, it was. DePape turned his attention back to the kneeling boy.
"Clean my boots," he said.
A look of muddled relief came onto Shimi's face. "Clean his boots, yes, you bet, right away." He pulled the rag he always kept in his back pocket. It wasn't even dirty yet. Not very, at least.
"Now?" DePape said patiently.
Shimi looked up at him, gaping and puzzled.
"Put that nasty clout back where it come from. I don't even want to look at it."
Shimi tucked it into his back pocket again.
"Lick him," DePape said in that same patient voice. "That's what I want. You lick my boots until they're dry again, and so clean you can see your stupid rabbit's face in him."
Shimi hesitated, as if still not sure what was required of him, or perhaps he was only processing the information.
"Right, do it, boy,"
Barky Callahan said from what he hoped was a safe place behind Sheb's piano.
"If you want to see the sun come up, I'd surely do it."
DePape had already decided the mush brain wasn't going to see another sunrise, not in this world, but kept quiet. He had never had his boots licked. He wanted to see what it felt like. If it was nice, kind of sexy-like, he could maybe try her nibs out on it.
"Does I have to?"
Shimi's eyes were filling with tears.
"Can't just I sorry and polish him real good?"
"Lick, you feeble-minded donkey," DePape said.
Shimi's hair fell across his forehead. His tongue poked tentatively out between his lips, and as he bent his head toward DePape's boots, the first of his tears fell.
"Stop it, stop it, stop it," a voice said.
It was shocking in the silence, not because it was sudden, and certainly not because it was angry. It was shocking because it was amused.
"I simply can't allow that."
"Nope. I would if I could, but I can't. Unsanitary, you see. Who knows what disease might be spread in such fashion? The mind quails, absolutely quails." Standing just inside the batwing doors was the purveyor of this idiotic and potentially fatal screed, a young man of middling height, his flat-crowned hat pushed back to reveal a tumbled comma of brown hair. Except young man didn't really cover him, DePape realized. Young man was drawing it heavy. He was only a kid. Around his neck, gods knew why, he wore a bird's skull like an enormous comical pendant. It was hung on a chain that ran through the eye holes, and in his hands was not a gun. Where would an unwhiskered dribble like him get a gun in the first place, DePape wondered, but a goddamn slingshot. DePape burst out laughing. The kid laughed as well, nodding as if he understood how ridiculous the whole thing looked, how ridiculous the whole thing was. His laughter was infectious. Petty, still up on her stool, tittered herself before clapping her hands over her mouth.
"This is no place for a boy such as you," DePape said.
His revolver, an old five-shooter, was still out. It lay in his fist on the bar with Stanley Ruiz's blood dripping off the gun sight. DePape, without raising it from the ironwood, waggled it slightly.
"Boys who come to places like this learn bad habits, kid. Dying is apt to be one of 'em. So I give you this one chance. Get out of here."
"Thank you, sir. I appreciate my one chance,"
the boy said. He spoke with great and winning sincerity, but didn't move. Still he stood just inside the batwing doors, with the wide elastic strap of his sling pulled back. DePape couldn't quite make out what was in the cup, but it glittered in the gaslight. A metal ball of some sort.
"Well, then,"
DePape snarled. This was getting old, and fast.
"I know I'm being a pain in the neck, sir, not to mention an ache in the ass and a milky drip from the tip of a sore dick. But if it's all the same to you, my dear friend, I'd like to give my chance to the young fellow on his knees before you. Let him apologize, let him polish your boots with his clout until you are entirely satisfied, and let him go on living his life."
There was an unfocused murmur of approval at this from the area where the card players were watching. DePape didn't like the sound of it at all, and he made a sudden decision. The boy would die as well, executed for the crime of impertinence. The swabby who had spilled the bucket of dregs on him was clearly retarded. Jan Brat had not even that excuse. He just thought he was funny. From the corner of his eye, DePape saw Reynolds moving to flank the boy, smooth as oiled silk. DePape appreciated the thought, but didn't believe he'd need much help with the slingshot specialist.
"Boy, I think you've made a mistake," he said in a kindly voice. "I really believe..."
The cup of the slingshot dipped a little, or DePape fancied it did. He made his move. 3. They talked about it in Hambry for years to come. 3 decades after the fall of Gilead and the end of the affiliation, they were still talking. By that time, there were better than 500 old gaffers and a few old gammers claiming that they were drinking a beer in the rest that night and saw it all. DePape was young and had the speed of a snake. Nevertheless, he never came close to getting a shot off at Cuthbert Allgood. There was a thip-twang as the elastic was released, a steel gleam that drew itself across the saloon's smoky air like a line on a slate board, and then DePape screamed. His revolver tumbled to the floor, and a foot spun it away from him across the sawdust. No one would claim that foot while the big coffin hunters were still in Hambry. Hundreds claimed it after they were gone. Still screaming, he could not bear pain, DePape raised his bleeding hand and looked at it with agonized, unbelieving eyes. Actually, he had been lucky. Cuthbert's ball had smashed the tip of the second finger and torn off the nail. Lower, and DePape would have been able to blow smoke rings through his own palm. Cuthbert, meanwhile, had already reloaded the cup of his slingshot and drawn the elastic back again. "Now," he said, "if I have your attention, good sir..."
"I can't speak for his," Ronald said from behind him, "but you got mine, partner. I don't know if you're good with that thing or just shit-ass lucky, but either way, you're done with it now. Relax the draw on it and put it down. That table in front of you's the place I want to see it."
"I've been blindsided," Cuthbert said sadly, "betrayed once more by my own callow youth."
"I don't know anything about your callow youth, brother, but you've been blindsided all right," Reynolds agreed.
He stood behind and slightly to the left of Cuthbert, and now he moved his gun forward until the boy could feel the muzzle against the back of his head. Reynolds thumbed the hammer. In the pool of silence which the traveler's rest had become, the sound was very loud.
"Now put that twanger down."
"I think, good sir, that I must offer my regrets and decline."
"What?"
"You see, I've got my trusty sling aimed at your pleasant friend's head," Cuthbert began, and when DePape shifted uneasily against the bar, Cuthbert's voice rose in a whip-crack that did not sound callow in the least.
"Stand still! Move again and you're a dead man!"
DePape subsided, holding his bloody hand against his pine-tacky shirt. For the first time he looked frightened, and for the first time that night... for the first time since hooking up with Jonas, in fact, Reynolds felt mastery of a situation on the verge of slipping away.
Except how could it be? How could it be when he'd been able to circle around this smart-talking squint and get the drop on him? This should be over.
Lowering his voice to its former conversational, not to say playful, pitch, Cuthbert said, "If you shoot me, the ball flies, and your friend dies too."
"I don't believe that," Reynolds said, but he didn't like what he heard in his own voice. It sounded like doubt. "No man can make a shot like that."
"Why don't we let your friend decide?"
Cuthbert raised his voice in a good-humored hail.
"Hi-ho there, Mr. Spectacles. Would you like your pal to shoot me?"
"No!"
DePape's cry was shrill, verging on panic.
"No, Clay! Don't shoot!"
"So it's a standoff," Reynolds said, bemused. And then bemusement changed to horror as he felt the blade of a very large knife slip against his throat. It pressed the tender skin just over his Adam's apple. "No, it's not," Alan said softly. "Put the gun down, my friend, or I'll cut your throat." Four. Standing outside the Batwing doors, having arrived by simple good fortune in time for this pinch-and-jilly show, Jonas watched with amazement, contempt, and something close to horror. First, one of the affiliation brats gets the drop on DePape, and when Reynolds covers that one, the big kid with the round face and the plowboy's shoulders puts a knife to Reynolds' throat. Neither of the brats a day over 15, and neither with a gun. Marvelous! He would have thought it better than a traveling circus, if not for the problems that would follow if this were not put right. What sort of work could they do in Hambry if it got around that the boogeymen were afraid of the children, instead of vice versa?
"There's time to stop this before there's killing, mayhap. If you want to, do you?"
Jonas decided he did, that they could walk out winners if they played it just right. He also decided the affiliation brats would not, unless they were very lucky indeed, be leaving Magus Barony alive.
"Where's the other one, Dearborn?"
A good question. An important question. Embarrassment would become outright humiliation if he found himself trumped in the same fashion as Roy and Clay. Dearborn wasn't in the bar, and that was sure. Jonas turned on his heels, scanning the South High Street in both directions. It was almost day bright under a kissing moon only two nights past the full. No one there. Not in the street, not on the far side, where Hambry's mercantile store stood. The mercantile had a porch, but there was nothing on it save for a line of carved totems illustrating guardians of the beam. Bear, turtle, fish, eagle, lion, bat, and wolf. 7 of 12, bright as marble in the moonlight, and no doubt great favorites of the kiddies. No men over there, though. Good. Lovely. Jonas peered hard into the thread of alley between the mercantile and the butcher's, glimpsed a shadow behind a tumble of cast-off boxes, tensed, then relaxed as he saw a cat's shining green eyes. He nodded and turned to the business at hand, pushing back the left-hand batwing and stepping into the traveler's rest. Alain heard the squeak of a hinge, but Jonas's gun was at his temple before he could even begin to turn.
"Sonny, unless you're a barber, I think you better put that pig sticker down. You don't get a second warning."
"No," Alain said.
Jonas, who had expected nothing but compliance and had been prepared for nothing else, was thunderstruck.
"What?"
"You heard me," Alain said. "I said no."
5. After making their manners and excusing themselves from Seafront, Roland had left his friends to their own amusements. They would finish up at the Traveler's Rest, he supposed, but wouldn't stay long or get into much trouble when they had no money for cards and could drink nothing more exciting than cold tea. He had ridden into town another way, tethered his mount at a public post in the lower of the two town squares. Rusher had offered a single puzzled knicker at this treatment, but no more, and had since been tramping the empty, sleeping streets with his hat yanked low over his eyes and his hands clasped into an aching knot at the small of his back. His mind was full of questions. Things were wrong here, very wrong. At first he'd thought that was just his imagination, the childish part of him finding make-believe troubles and storybook intrigue because he had been removed from the heart of the real action. But after his talk with Rennie Renfrew, he knew better. There were questions, outright mysteries, and the most hellish thing of all was that he couldn't concentrate on them, let alone go any distance toward making sense of them. Every time he tried, Susan Delgado's face intruded. Her face, or the sweep of her hair, or even the pretty, fearless way her silk-slippered feet had followed his boots in the dance, never lagging or hesitating.
Again and again he heard the last thing he had said to her, speaking in the stilted, priggish voice of a boy preacher. He would have given almost anything to take back both the tone and the words themselves. She'd be on Thorin's pillow come reaptide and kindle him a child before the first snow flew, perhaps a male heir, and what of it? Rich men, famous men, and well-blooded men had taken Gilly girls since the beginning of time. Arthur Eld had had better than 40 himself, according to the tales, so really, what was it to him? I think I've gone and fallen in love with her. That's what it is to me. A dismaying idea, but not a dismissible one. He knew the landscape of his own heart too well. He loved her. Very likely it was so. But part of him also hated her, and held to the shocking thought he'd had at dinner, that he could have shot Susan Delgado through the heart if he'd come armed. Some of this was jealousy, but not all, perhaps not even the greater part. He had made some indefinable but powerful connection between Olive Thorin, her sad but game little smile from the foot of the table, and his own mother. Hadn't some of that same woeful, rueful look been in his mother's eyes on the day when he had come upon her and his father's advisor? Martin in an open-throated shirt, Gabrielle Deschain in a sack that had slipped off one shoulder, the whole room reeking of what they had been up to that hot morning? His mind, tough as it already was, shrank from the image, horrified. It returned instead to that of Susan Delgado, her gray eyes and shining hair. He saw her laughing, chin up-tilted, hands clasped before the sapphire Thorin had given her. Roland